Hey everyone, real quick, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. So they've got this full Series 65 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and, you know, unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing. It's super helpful, so check it out at CertFuel.com.
Definitely worth a look if you're gearing up for the test.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so I want you to imagine a client who... let's say they just sold their tech startup for $50 million.
Right.
Like, they're completely set for life.
Oh, yeah. Generational wealth, totally secure.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But because, you know, their financial advisor failed to ask one crucial question during, like, a 15-minute onboarding interview, they lose half of that wealth in a market panic.
Ouch.
Yeah. And then they sue your firm.
Yeah.
And you permanently lose your license. Like, I mean, it happens way faster than you think.
It happens every single day, honestly, because, you know, we tend to view finance as this pristine, perfect realm of mathematics.
Like, it's all just spreadsheets and formulas.
Yeah, exactly. You run the Monte Carlo simulations, you build the efficient frontier, and the math tells you exactly what to do. But none of that math matters until it collides with a messy, irrational human being.
Which brings us to our mission today. So welcome to the deep dive, everyone. Today, we are tearing into the incredibly high-stakes, legally treacherous world of client profile development.
It is a minefield.
It really is. And if you are preparing for the Series 65 exam, you should know this topic makes up about 7% of your test.
So that's roughly 6 questions standing between you and a passing score.
Right. But we aren't just going to memorize a list of terms today. I mean, that's boring. We are going to look at the psychological mechanics and, you know, the legal history behind these rules so that you actually understand how to apply them.
Because, honestly, this entire topic boils down to one fundamental legal reality. You cannot legally or ethically really recommend a single investment to a client until you know exactly who they are and what their entire financial and psychological life looks like.
Otherwise, you're just throwing darts in the dark.
Exactly. You are operating completely blind, and operating blind as a fiduciary is, well, it's illegal.
So, since we are really targeting that ADHD learning style today, you know, we know that dry textbook lists are just going to bounce right off your brain.
Right. They definitely bounce off mine.
Same. So, to make these concepts absolutely bulletproof in your memory, we are bringing in a recurring cast of characters today.
Oh, this is going to be fun.
We are going to put them through absolute hell today, so that you can see how the rules apply in real time.
All right. Well, first up, we have Frank, the founder. So Frank is 55. He just sold a massive software as a service company, and he has this dangerously inflated ego.
Oh, we all know a Frank.
Right.
Right.
Because he was a genius at building a tech platform, he assumes he is also a genius at macroeconomic forecasting and, you know, picking individual stocks.
Total recipe for disaster. Okay. Next, we have Anxious Annie.
Let's hear it.
Annie is 28. She's a corporate lawyer pulling in, like, $400,000 a year, but she watched her parents lose their house in the 2008 financial crisis.
Oh, so she's got some trauma there.
Major trauma. As a result, she is utterly terrified of the stock market. If she sees the S&P 500 drop by 0.5% on a Tuesday, her heart rate spikes and she wants to liquidate everything.
Wow, okay. She represents a really fascinating dilemma for an advisor.
She really does. And finally, we have Reckless Rick.
Reckless Rick.
Rick is 45, he's stuck in middle management, and he basically treats his annual corporate bonus like casino chips.
So he's gambling it all?
Pretty much. Okay. He throws it at whatever leveraged crypto ETF is trending on social media, all while carrying like $30,000 in credit card debt.
Oh, that hurts to hear.
Right. But the kicker is, when he fills out official paperwork, he claims he wants safe, guaranteed investments for his retirement.
Rick is a walking contradiction.
He really is. So to you, the listener, our game plan today is to dissect the mechanics of these three clients. And along the way, we are going to flag the exact traps the exam writers use to trick candidates.
I love that. Let's call them exam gotchas. Whenever you hear exam gotcha, perk up, because that is where the test writers are actively trying to fail you.
Perfect. So let's jump right into the foundation, part one. When Frank or Annie walks into your office for the first time, you have to gather data. But there are two entirely separate regulatory universes operating simultaneously here.
This is huge. Candidates constantly conflate these two things. So you have the customer identification program, or the CIP, and then you have suitability.
And they sound similar, right? Because they both involve asking the client questions.
Yeah, exactly. But their legal origins and purposes are entirely different.
Let's start with the CIP. I mean, this is an SEC rule, right? This goes back to the USA Patriot Act.
It does. Following the attacks of September 11th, the federal government realized how easily illicit funds were moving through the U.S. banking and investment
So
systems.
they cracked down.
Big time. They drastically expanded anti-money laundering regulations, commonly called AML. The primary directive was clear: you must know exactly who is opening this account to prevent terrorists and cartels from washing money.
So, for a natural person, meaning a human being, not a corporation, the CIP requires four absolute minimum pieces of information before you can open the account.
Just four, but they are mandatory.
Right. You need their legal name, their date of birth, a residential street address, and an identification number, which for a U.S. citizen is usually a social security number.
And let's focus on that residential street address for a second, because the actual mechanics of money laundering explain why this is so strict.
What do you mean?
Well, a post office box is not allowed for identity verification. Why? Because you can't physically raid a PO box to arrest a cartel operative.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that makes sense.
The government needs to know the actual physical location where the account owner resides. Now, you can use a PO box for mailing statements, but the legal domicile on file must be a physical street address.
Okay, so let me stop you there and pose a direct question to the listener. Listen to this setup. If you're taking this Series 65 and you see a multiple choice question asking, "What information must an advisor collect to determine a client's suitability?" And one of the options is date of birth and residential address, do you pick it?
Think about it for a second.
You might intuitively think, "Yeah, I definitely need those things." But if you select that, you fall right into a classic exam.
Gotcha. It is perhaps the most common trap in this entire section, because, like we said, the CIP and suitability are totally different regulatory lanes.
So break that down for us.
The CIP answers one question: who are you? It proves identity. Suitability answers the question: what do you need? It proves their financial picture.
Okay, so knowing that Anxious Annie was born in 1998 and lives on Elm Street tells you absolutely nothing about her risk tolerance.
Nothing at all. It doesn't tell you her net worth or whether she should be in municipal bonds or tech stocks.
It's basically the difference between a bouncer checking an ID at the door of a club versus the bartender figuring out what drink they actually want to order.
That is a great analogy. You need to do both, but checking the ID doesn't tell you if they want a martini or a soda.
Right. So, to figure out what they actually need for their portfolio, we use questionnaires and interviews.
Yeah, and questionnaires are your standard forms. They cover the financial situation, the goals, risk tolerance, and time
I
horizon.
feel like compliance departments just love those things.
Oh, they do, because they are standardized, scalable, and they create a very clean paper trail. But they have a massive fatal limitation.
And that limitation is human psychology, right?
100%.
I would say a questionnaire is essentially a financial dating app profile. Think about how people fill those out. They either genuinely misunderstand themselves or they unconsciously lie to look better.
Yes. For example, Anxious Annie might check the box for aggressive risk tolerance on the form.
Why would she do that if she's terrified?
Because the form probably says aggressive portfolios yield higher long-term returns. She wants the high returns. But she fundamentally misunderstands the mechanism of risk, that aggressive means she has to endure a 40% drop in a bad year without panicking.
Which we know she absolutely cannot do, which is exactly why the physical interview is mandatory, isn't it?
It has to be. The interview is the actual first date. It's where you stress test that dating profile and look for red flags.
So you look Anxious Annie in the eye and say, "Hey, I see you check the aggressive box. The portfolio we build for that could lose $80,000 over the next 6 months. How would you react?"
Right. And when she physically winces, goes pale, and tells you she would immediately sell everything and move to Cashwell, you have just uncovered a massive inconsistency.
The math on the paper said aggressive, but her nervous system just told you she's super conservative.
Exactly. Best practice dictates you always combine the standardized questionnaire with the dynamic interview to catch those discrepancies.
Okay, so once you gather all this data, you have to codify it somehow. You don't just keep it in your head. You draft the IPS.
Ah, yes, the investment policy statement.
Let's unpack the IPS because this is a term candidates hear constantly on the exam. What is it? mechanically.
Mechanically, it is the holy grail of the advisory relationship. It is the written governing document that dictates everything you're about to do with their money.
So it's basically the master blueprint.
Exactly. It houses the client's objectives, their constraints like liquidity needs or tax issues, the target asset allocation, the specific benchmarks you will use to measure success, and the schedule for portfolio reviews.
From a liability standpoint, that sounds critical.
Oh, it's everything. Every single trade or recommendation you make must trace its justification back to the IPS.
All right, let's test this with a scenario for the listener. So Frank, the founder, finally sells his SaaS company. Let's say he walks away with $10 million in liquid cash.
Must be nice.
Right, so he calls you, his advisor, with the big news. What is the very first step you should take? Is it researching large cap dividend stocks to generate income? Or maybe laddering treasury bonds to protect the principal?
Listener, give it a beat. Think about it.
The answer is neither of those things. The very first step is to review and update the investment policy statement.
Huge testing point right there. Exam. Gotcha. The IPS is not a stagnant onboarding document that gets shoved into a digital filing cabinet. It is a living, breathing contract.
So when a major life event occurs, the entire foundation of the client's financial picture shifts. You must update the blueprint before you buy a single nail.
You have to.
Let me push back on this a bit just to make sure I really understand the mechanics here. Are you telling me that a specific mutual fund that Frank currently holds in his portfolio can magically become an unsuitable investment overnight?
Yeah.
Even if the fund itself didn't change its strategy or its manager one bit?
I am absolutely telling you that. And it's a profound shift in how candidates need to think about suitability.
So suitability isn't just about the product itself.
No, suitability does not exist in a vacuum. It is a relative concept. It is the relationship between the investment and the investor.
Okay, so give us an example.
Well, when Frank was building his business, he had a massive income stream and a long time horizon. A highly aggressive, volatile, small cap equity fund might have been perfectly suitable for him back then.
Right, because he had time and cash flow.
Exactly. But the moment he sells the business, retires, and relies on that portfolio to generate stable, predictable monthly income to pay his mortgage, that exact same small cap fund becomes a massive suitability violation.
Wow. The investment didn't change at all. The client changed. The context changed. That is a really brilliant way to look at it.
Context is everything on this exam.
Okay, let's pivot into part two. Current and future financial situation. We've established who they are and how to document it. Now we had to figure out how much money they actually have.
Right. And to do that, we need to understand the difference between the snapshot and the video.
This is a great visual. We are talking about the balance sheet versus cash flow.
Exactly. To build a competent profile, you have to understand where the client's wealth sits today and the velocity of the money moving in and out of their life.
So the balance sheet is the snapshot. It's like a photograph taken at a specific millisecond in time. The formula is assets minus liabilities equals net worth.
What do you own and what do you owe right this very second?
Right. Cash flow, on the other hand, is the video recording. It's income minus expenses measured over a period of time, like a month or a year. It tracks the movement.
And you really have to assess the stability of that video recording. For example, Anxious Annie has a highly stable, predictable corporate salary.
She gets paid the same amount every 2 weeks.
Right. But Frank, the founder, when he was running his company, had highly variable income depending on quarterly sales.
And then there's Reckless Rick.
Right. Rick relies heavily on a once a year discretionary bonus. Their cash flow volatility completely dictates how much of a liquid emergency fund they need on that balance sheet.
Okay, let's run a math scenario that trips up a lot of people. Listener, think about this carefully. We have Reckless Rick. Rick has exactly $4,000 sitting in his checking account.
Okay, $4,000.
He also has a credit card with a $4,000 balance that is charging him a brutal 24% interest rate.
Typical Rick.
Rick finally takes some good advice, takes the cash from his checking account, and pays off the credit card down to zero. How much does Rick's net worth increase after he hits the submit button on that payment?
If you're rushing through the exam, your brain immediately screams that he is richer. Paying off 24% debt feels like a massive financial win.
It feels great. But mathematically, his net worth increased by exactly zero.
Exam. Gotcha right there. Let's walk through the T accounting of why that happens.
Okay, break it down for us.
Net worth is assets minus liabilities. So before the payment, Rick had $4,000 in assets and $4,000 in liabilities. Net worth is zero. He uses the asset to destroy the liability. His assets go down by 4,000. His liabilities go down by 4,000. Both sides of the equation decrease by the exact same amount simultaneously.
So his net worth remains exactly zero.
Precisely. Now, obviously, his future cash flow will improve because he isn't bleeding out interest payments every month, but at the exact millisecond of the transaction, the balance sheet snapshot does not change.
The exam loves to test if you can separate the emotional feeling of paying off debt from the cold math of a balance sheet. That's a great distinction.
Totally. Now, what about existing investments?
Right. Before you allocate a single dollar of new money, you have to conduct an autopsy on what they already own. You are specifically looking for concentration risk, restricted assets, and tax location.
Let's use Frank, the founder, for this one. Frank has 60% of his entire net worth tied up in a single tech stock from an old employer.
Huge red flag.
Right. He comes to you, his new advisor, and says he wants to invest his new cash. Now, you, the advisor, have been reading institutional reports about a brand new artificial intelligence tech stock.
Okay, AI is hot.
The fundamentals are pristine. It has a bulletproof moat, incredible cash flow, and every analyst rates it a strong buy. It is objectively a fantastic investment. Should you recommend Frank buy it?
Listener, what do you think? I mean, it's a great stock, right?
No, you absolutely should not. This is a scenario the test writers use to see if you understand total portfolio context.
Why is it bad if the stock is good?
The security itself is amazing, but if you put Frank into another tech stock, you are wildly exacerbating his unsystematic risk. He is already 60% concentrated in the technology sector.
Ah, so if the tech sector experiences like a regulatory crackdown, his entire net worth basically implodes.
Exactly. So even the greatest stock in the world can be a suitability violation if it ruins the client's diversification. You have to recommend an asset class that has a low correlation to what he already owns.
Okay, and beyond concentration, we have to look at the tax situation, right?
Yes. Frank, the founder, with his massive windfall, is now in the highest marginal tax bracket at the federal level.
Which means every dollar of ordinary income he generates is getting taxed at nearly 40%. That's rough.
It is, which is why Frank is a prime candidate for municipal bonds. The interest generated by municipal bonds is generally exempt from federal income taxes.
But the exam will push this one step further, right? They'll test your geographical awareness regarding state taxes.
Yep. Because if Frank lives in California or New York, he is facing brutal state income taxes on top of the federal rate.
Right. But if he lives in Texas or Florida, there is no state income tax.
So the portfolio construction changes radically based on his zip code. A client in California might need specific in-state municipal bonds to achieve double tax exemption, meaning free from both federal and state taxes.
But a client in Texas only needs to worry about the federal exemption. You really have to gather that geographical data to solve the tax puzzle.
You do. It's a critical part of the profile.
Okay, we are about to discuss a concept that completely blew my mind when I first learned it. Let's talk about Social Security, pensions,
Yeah.
and what we call the guaranteed income trap.
This is a fun one. To understand the trap, you first have to understand the mechanics of Social Security. The benefits are calculated based on your highest 35 years of earnings.
Okay.
Now, you are allowed to claim benefits as early as age 62, but doing so permanently reduces your monthly payout. Full retirement age for most people taking the exam today is 67.
But there's a trick to waiting.
A massive trick. If you delay claiming those benefits from age 62 all the way to age 70, your monthly benefit increases by approximately 77%.
A guaranteed 77% increase just for waiting.
Yeah.
That is crazy.
It's the best guaranteed return you'll ever get. Now, let's pair that with a defined benefit pension. A pension provides a guaranteed monthly check for the rest of your life, regardless of whether the stock market is up 30% or down 30%.
So, listener, think about this scenario. Frank, the founder, retires. He has a massive guaranteed pension from a previous corporate career that pays him $10,000 a month, guaranteed for life.
Very comfortable.
Very. Does this mean Frank's investment portfolio should be shifted to ultra-conservative bonds because he is an older, retired guy?
Intuitively, people think he's retired, so he needs to be conservative. But mechanically, it means the exact opposite. And candidates get this wrong constantly. Exam. Gotcha.
Okay, walk us through the mechanics of why. Why would a retired guy with a pension be told to take more risk? It sounds completely backwards.
Because you have to look at the pension mathematically, not emotionally. When a client has a massive source of guaranteed income, whether it's a huge pension or a maxed out Social Security benefit, that income stream acts mathematically like a giant risk-free bond allocation on their personal balance sheet.
Oh, it's like the ultimate safety net.
Exactly. Because Frank's basic living expenses, his mortgage, groceries, utilities are completely covered by this guaranteed money, he has a significantly reduced need for his actual investment portfolio to generate safe current income.
Wait, so because the safety net is so strong, it actually allows him to jump higher with the rest of his money.
Precisely. It expands his risk capacity. Because he doesn't need to sell his stocks to buy groceries, he can afford to tilt his brokerage portfolio toward aggressive growth equities.
That makes so much sense.
Right. He has the mathematical capacity to endure a massive market crash because his daily life won't change one bit. The guaranteed income doesn't make him conservative. It frees up the rest of the portfolio to be aggressive.
That is such a brilliant paradigm shift. The test is trying to see if you just blindly associate the word retirement with bonds, or if you actually understand how cash flow dictates risk capacity.
The only mechanical caveat you must check is whether that pension has a KLA, a cost of living adjustment.
Why does that matter?
Well, if it pays a flat $10,000 forever, inflation will slowly destroy its purchasing power over the next 20 years.
Ah, so it actually buys less stuff over time.
Right. Which actually reinforces the need for the investment portfolio to hold equities, because equities are one of the only asset classes that consistently outpace long-term inflation.
Okay, so we know what they have. Let's move to part three, financial goals. We need to know what they actually want. And more importantly, we need to know how to handle the situation when what they want makes absolutely no mathematical sense.
Goals dictate the destination. The asset allocation, product selection, risk budget, it all flows backward from the stated goal, and the exam will test whether you know the strict definitions of these goals.
Let's do a side-by-side comparison of two terms that sound basically identical to a layperson, but are mechanically opposites. Capital preservation versus current income.
They are not the same thing at all. Capital preservation means the absolute protection of the principal amount invested.
The client is saying, I cannot afford to lose the money I put in.
Exactly. To achieve this, you use instruments with practically zero default risk and zero interest rate risk. Treasury bills, money market funds, bank certificates of deposit. The primary goal is safety. The yield is a total afterthought.
Current income, on the other hand, means the primary goal is generating steady cash flow dividends and interest payments.
Right. And to get that cash flow, you use corporate bonds, municipal bonds, preferred stock, or dividend-paying equities.
And here is where the mechanics of the market create a trap for candidates. If anxious Annie comes to you and says, "Hey, I'm retiring. I need my portfolio to generate cash for me to live on, but I'm terrified and absolutely cannot afford to lose any of my initial investment," she is stating two conflicting goals.
She wants to have her cake and eat it too.
Why do they conflict, though? Well, walk us through the seesaw effect of bonds.
Because generating income requires taking on risk. If you buy a 10-year corporate bond to get a 5% yield, and the Federal Reserve suddenly raises interest rates to 7%, the market value of your 5% bond will drop significantly.
Right. Nobody wants your 5% bond if they can get a new one paying seven.
Exactly. It's the seesaw rates go up, existing bond prices go down. Even though you are still getting your income, the principal value of your portfolio has declined.
So if Annie truly, fundamentally cannot stomach the idea of losing a single penny of her principal, then bonds will fail her.
Yep. If her absolute constraint is zero loss, her goal is preservation, not income. You have to sacrifice the yield to guarantee the safety.
Okay, you also need to cleanly separate growth from speculation.
Very important. Growth is capital appreciation over a long time horizon. You are buying ownership in solid, fundamentally sound companies or broad index funds and letting the macroeconomic engine of the economy compound your wealth over decades.
Speculation is totally different. Speculation is attempting to maximize short-term returns by accepting an exceptionally high risk of total loss.
This is reckless Rick buying out-of-the-money call options on a meme stock expiring on Friday.
Classic Rick. And from a regulatory standpoint, you can only allow a client to speculate using risk capital, right?
Yes. Risk capital is strictly defined as money the client can afford to literally set on fire without it altering their standard of living or delaying their retirement.
So if Rick tries to speculate with his kid's 529 college savings plan, you have a fiduciary obligation to stop him. It's not risk capital.
You must stop him.
Okay, so how do we structure a portfolio when a client has multiple valid goals?
We use a hierarchy. You separate them into primary and secondary goals. The primary goal is the engine of the portfolio. It dictates the core asset allocation strategy. The secondary goal is the accessory package.
Let's visualize this for the listener. If Frank the founder says his primary goal is long-term growth, but his secondary goal is current income, how do you build that? Do you just split the portfolio half into tech stocks and half into corporate bonds?
No, because bonds don't serve the primary engine of long-term growth. Instead, you look for assets that do both, but prioritize the engine.
What would that be?
You would construct a portfolio of large-cap, dividend-paying equities. The equities provide the long-term growth engine, and the dividends serve as the income accessory.
Smart. But what happens when the client demands a portfolio that just defies the laws of physics? Like, Anxious Annie sits down and says, I want aggressive double-digit returns every single year, but I want absolutely zero risk of ever losing my principal.
Welcome to the daily life of an advisor.
Right.
The exam will test you on exactly how to handle this via the conflict resolution protocol. Step one, you have a fiduciary duty to educate the client that their goals are mathematically contradictory. You have to explain the risk-return trade-off, that risk-free high returns do not exist.
In step two, you don't just listen to what they say. You look at their actual financial situation.
Yeah.
Because the balance sheet doesn't lie.
It doesn't.
Yeah.
And step three, this is the critical exam point when ambiguity persists. When the client refuses to budge and their stated goals conflict with their financial reality, the advisor must default to the more conservative interpretation of the data.
And you must document everything.
Document every single conversation.
I love this rule. The stated goal does not always win. If Annie writes aggressive growth on the intake form, but her financials and her emotional reactions scream conservative, you do not put her in speculative tech stocks just to make her happy in the moment.
Right, because you are protecting her from herself. You resolve the conflict by defaulting conservative.
That transitions perfectly into part four, risk. We've established the destination with their goals, but risk dictates the vehicle we use to get there. Can the client actually survive the bumpy ride without jumping out of the moving car?
To figure this out, we have to evaluate the two pillars of risk capacity versus willingness.
Objective math versus subjective emotion. Let's use an engineering analogy for this. Let's talk about bridges.
Oh, that's a perfect analogy. So risk capacity is the structural integrity of the bridge. It is objective. It is pure math. Capacity is determined by the client's net worth, their time horizon, the stability of their income, and their liquidity needs. If you are 25, making a high salary, and have zero debt, your structural capacity is massive.
The bridge can hold a 10-ton truck because you have decades to recover from a market crash.
Exactly. Risk willingness, on the other hand, is the driver of the truck. It's their psychological attitude. It is totally subjective.
It's how fast the driver is willing to drive over the bridge in a storm. It's how much Anxious Annie sweats when the market drops 2% in an hour.
And the entire focus of the exam, and frankly, the hardest part of being an advisor, is what you do when the physical bridge and the emotional driver are completely out of sync.
Okay, let's run the decision tree for these conflicts. Mm-hmm. Scenario A, high willingness, low capacity. This is Reckless Rick. Let's say Rick is 64. He is retiring next year.
Okay, so time is short.
Very short. He has massive credit card debt, very little in savings, and his structural bridge is essentially made of rotting wood. His capacity is incredibly low.
But his willingness is off the charts.
Exactly. He comes into your office and says, I want to take my last $50,000 and bet it all on a triple leveraged crypto ETF to catch up for retirement. What is your legal obligation?
You absolutely refuse to execute that strategy, period. As an investment advisor, operating under a fiduciary duty, capacity always overrides willingness when capacity is low.
The bridge collapses if you let him drive the truck over it.
That's right. It does not matter how brave Reckless Rick feels. He does not have the mathematical ability to sustain the inevitable loss. If that crypto ETF drops by 60%, his retirement is permanently destroyed.
So you must protect him from his own psychological overconfidence and recommend a conservative portfolio that preserves his limited capital.
Boom. The math wins. Capacity overrides willingness when capacity is low.
But now, let's flip the scenario, because this is where the psychology gets really nuanced on the exam. Scenario B. Low willingness, high capacity. This is Anxious Annie.
Right. So Annie is 28. She makes $400,000 a year. She has no debt and $1 million in the bank. Her structural bridge is made of solid titanium.
Her capacity is astronomical. She could lose half her portfolio tomorrow and be perfectly fine in 30 years.
But she is terrified. Her willingness is zero. She tells you she wants to keep all of her retirement money in a bank savings account earning 1%.
So, listener, here's the question. Do you just nod, check the cash box on the form, and put her in a savings account because she's the client and she asked for it?
Take a second. What do you think?
No, you do not.
Fiduciary duty means you are an advisor, not an order taker. If you just put her in cash, you are actively failing her. You have a duty to educate her on the silent, invisible risk she is ignoring inflation.
Walk us through how you explain that to her mechanically.
You have to show her the math. If inflation averages 3% a year and her money is earning 1%, she is guaranteed to lose 2% of her purchasing power every single year.
It's like a slow leak in a tire.
Exactly. Over 40 years, keeping her money safe in cash will mathematically guarantee that she runs out of money in retirement. You have to educate her that taking some market volatility is actually safer than the guaranteed destruction of inflation.
Okay, so you spend 3 sessions educating her. You show her the charts, the history of the S&P 500, the inflation metrics. But what if, after all of that, she is still hyperventilating at the thought of buying a stock index fund? What do you do then?
Then, ultimately, you must accommodate her low willingness.
Wait, really? We just said capacity overrides willingness?
Yes, but this is the nuance the exam tests. If you ignore her terror and put her in an aggressive equity portfolio simply because the math says she can handle it, what happens the first time the market drops 10%?
She panics. She logs into her account at 2 a.m. and hits the sell button on everything.
Exactly. She liquidates at the absolute bottom of a correction, turning a temporary paper loss into a permanent, catastrophic, realized loss.
Oh, wow. So you actually hurt her by forcing her into the right math.
Right. An aggressive portfolio that a client cannot emotionally endure is, by definition, an unsuitable portfolio. You must scale back the risk to a level she can sleep with. But the exam wants to see that you rigorously discussed and educated her first, rather than just blindly accommodating her irrational fear from day one.
That is brilliant. You respect the willingness eventually to prevent panic selling, but you must fight it with education first.
And speaking of measuring that fear, let's look at risk tolerance questionnaires and a psychological phenomenon called recency bias.
This is huge. Questionnaires are static pieces of paper, but human emotions are incredibly dynamic. The way a client answers a risk tolerance questionnaire is heavily influenced by what the stock market did yesterday. Let's explain the mechanics of recency bias. It's basically an evolutionary shortcut in the brain. The brain assumes that whatever happened most recently is going to continue happening forever.
Right.
So if you hand Reckless Rick a risk questionnaire in the middle of a raging 5-year bull market where every tech stock goes up every day, how does he fill it out?
He checks the maximum aggressive box for every single answer. He feels invincible because he has only experienced gains. He thinks a 20% return is the new normal.
But if you give him that exact same piece of paper the day after the market crashes 20% due to, say, a global pandemic, suddenly he's checking the conservative boxes.
His mathematical capacity didn't change overnight. His net worth is roughly the same. His time horizon is the same. But his emotional tolerance collapsed. Risk tolerance is not a permanent tattoo. It's a mood ring.
I love that. A mood ring. Which is exactly why the objective math, the risk capacity, must serve as the anchor for the financial plan.
Because the math does not care about the market's mood, and it doesn't care about the news cycle.
Let's pivot to part 5, time horizon. Risk capacity is inextricably tied to the clock. The amount of time we have dictates the tools we can use.
Time horizon is simply defined as the expected period of time before the client needs to withdraw and spend the invested funds. We generally break this into 3 distinct buckets, and the exam expects you to know the asset allocations for each.
Let's run through the buckets. Short term is anything under 3 years.
If the time horizon is under 3 years, the primary focus must be capital preservation. The stock market is far too volatile over a 3-year period. A sudden recession could wipe out 30% of the value right when the client needs the cash.
So you must use cash equivalents, money market funds, or highly rated short-term bonds.
Right. Now, medium term is 3 to 10 years.
What goes in there?
Here, you have enough time to recover from a minor correction so you can introduce a balanced mix. You might see a portfolio of 50% equities and 50% intermediate term bonds.
Okay, and long term is 10 plus years.
With a decade or more, you have the runway to endure full economic cycles, recessions, and expansions. This allows for a growth focus, meaning a heavy allocation to equities, perhaps 80 to 100% stocks for younger clients.
Now, here is a major trap for candidates. A single client does not have just one time horizon. A client is not simply long-term or short-term. Their goals have time horizons.
Exactly. Asset allocation should be set per goal, not per client.
It's like packing for a trip, right? Mixing time horizons is like packing a heavy winter snowsuit for a beach vacation just because you're going skiing 6 months later. You need different suitcases.
That's a great way to think about it. If Anxious Annie has a $30,000 emergency fund, that specific bucket of money has an immediate neuro-day time horizon. It must be highly liquid and completely safe.
But she also has a 401k retirement account that she won't touch for 30 years. That is a long-term horizon.
They require completely separate, siloed asset allocations. You cannot average them out. You can't say, well, one is immediate and one is 30 years, so I'll put everything in a moderate 15-year medium risk portfolio.
Because that exposes the emergency fund to market risk, which defeats its whole purpose.
Exactly. And now we arrive at one of the most frequently tested traps on the entire Series 65, the 2 versus 3 retirement trap.
I'm going to ask the listener directly. Think about the mechanics of this. Frank, the founder, is exactly 65 years old. He is retiring tomorrow morning at 9:00 a.m. He will never earn another paycheck. What is the time horizon for his retirement portfolio?
If a candidate answers 0 years or short term, they fundamentally misunderstand the mechanics of the distribution phase and they will fail the question.
So walk us through the math of a modern retirement. Why isn't his horizon zero?
Because Frank is 65. With modern medicine, life expectancies are stretching into the 90s. Frank and his spouse could easily live to be 95.
Right.
That means his portfolio does not just need to get him to retirement tomorrow. It has to survive and generate income through a 30-year retirement. His time horizon is 30 years.
So time horizon does not equal current age. It equals life expectancy combined with goal duration.
Yes. A 30-year horizon means a significant portion of his portfolio still needs to be invested in equities to outpace 3 decades of inflation.
But this introduces a terrifying mathematical concept called sequence of returns risk.
This is crucial. Sequence of returns risk is the danger of experiencing a severe market crash early in retirement while you are simultaneously withdrawing funds.
Let's run the hypothetical. Let's say Frank has $1 million. Scenario A. The market drops 20% in his first year of retirement. He also has to withdraw $50,000 to live on.
Okay, so the math gets ugly here.
Really ugly. Because the market crashed, his portfolio is down to $800,000. But he still needs cash, so he is forced to sell shares at rock-bottom prices. By selling at the bottom, he permanently destroys those shares' ability to recover when the market eventually bounces back. He has structurally crippled his portfolio.
It's devastating. But look at scenario B. If the market goes up 20% in his first few years, he is selling a small number of highly appreciated shares to generate his $50,000, leaving the vast majority of his shares to continue compounding.
So it could be the exact same average return over 30 years, but the sequence of those returns dictates whether he dies wealthy or runs out of money at age 80.
Which is exactly why the 5 to 10 years before retirement, what we call the retirement red zone, is when risk capacity actually drops the most.
Because if a crash happens, then you don't have time to recover.
Right. As an advisor, you start building a cash and short-term bond buffer during those pre-retirement years so that if a crash happens in year one, Frank can spend the safe cash instead of selling his stocks at the bottom.
You build a short-term liquidity bucket to protect the long-term equity engine. This is so fascinating. It's all interconnected mechanics.
Truly is.
All right, let's unpack part 6. Non-financial factors and behavioral biases. We call this the psychology of money. We spent the last 40 minutes talking about pristine math, T-accounts, and asset allocation buckets. Now, how does the messy, irrational human brain impact that math?
We have to start with values. Clients are not just calculating machines. They have morals, religions, and worldviews. This is where we see ESG, environmental, social, and governance criteria.
So a client might request socially responsible investing, or SRI, where they explicitly exclude certain sectors like tobacco, firearms, or fossil fuels.
Or they might request faith-based investing, like a Sharia-compliant portfolio that strictly avoids interest-bearing instruments like traditional bonds.
As a fiduciary, your legal duty is to respect these values and incorporate them into the IPS, even if doing so inherently reduces the portfolio's diversification or limits its potential returns. You document that the client accepted the trade-off.
But here's the trap. Gotcha, right here. The exam will try to blur the lines between the advisor's values and the client's values. ESG mandates are entirely 100% client-driven.
Wait, so if I, as the advisor, am incredibly passionate about green energy and climate change, I can't just put my clients in green funds?
No, you cannot unilaterally impose an ESG filter onto Frank the Founder's portfolio without his explicit request and consent. That would be a massive breach of fiduciary duty. You are managing their money, not projecting your morals.
Wow, okay. Now, beyond conscious values, we have to look at unconscious cognitive errors. Behavioral finance is a massive part of the exam. It studies the psychological mechanisms behind why investors consistently make terrible, irrational decisions.
And they really do.
We're going to dig into the psychological mechanics of these biases.
Yeah.
Because you will absolutely see scenario-based questions asking you to identify which bias is occurring. Let's start with anchoring.
Anchoring is a cognitive heuristic, a mental shortcut. It occurs when a person relies excessively on the very first piece of information they receive when making a decision, regardless of whether that information is still relevant.
And in finance, this is almost always the original purchase price of an asset, right?
Almost always. Let's apply it to Anxious Annie. Annie buys a pharmaceutical stock at $80 a share. 3 months later, the FDA rejects their flagship drug.
Oof, bad news.
Terrible. The company's earnings projections collapse, the CEO resigns, and the stock price plummets to $50. You call Annie and advise her to sell because the fundamental reason for owning the company is gone. What does she say?
She refuses. She says, I can't sell it for a loss. I just need it to get back to $80 and then I'll sell.
She is anchored to the number 80. Her brain has fixed that number as the true value of the stock, completely ignoring the new reality that the company is fundamentally broken.
So as the advisor, your job is to break the anchor. You reframe the scenario. You ask her, Annie, if you didn't own this stock and you had $50 in cash today, would you buy this company knowing the FDA just rejected their drug?
And when she says absolutely not, you reply, then holding it today is the exact same thing. You break the cognitive loop.
Next up, the most powerful force in behavioral finance, loss aversion and its resulting behavior, the disposition effect.
Loss aversion stems from a psychological framework called prospect theory, pioneered by Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky. Evolutionary biology basically wired the human brain to prioritize survival.
So in the ancestral environment, finding extra food a gain was nice, but losing your existing food a loss meant starvation and death.
Therefore, the human brain processes negative emotions much more intensely than positive ones. To put numbers to it, studies show that losing $100 hurts about twice as much as finding $100 feels good.
And this asymmetric emotional response creates the disposition effect in investing. Because realizing a loss feels psychologically devastating, like admitting a personal failure, clients will hold on to a losing stock indefinitely.
They refuse to sell, hoping it bounces back so they don't have to experience the pain of actualizing the loss.
But what do they do when a stock goes up 10%?
Because they are so desperate for a psychological win, they sell the winning stock prematurely to lock in the positive feeling.
So they hold the losers forever and sell the winners instantly. If you run that algorithm for 10 years, what does the portfolio look like?
The portfolio gets completely hollowed out. It becomes a graveyard filled entirely with garbage, underperforming stocks because all the high-quality growth engines were sold off too early.
Your job as an advisor is to shift their focus away from the individual line items. You have to force them to evaluate the performance of the total portfolio to mitigate that line item anxiety.
Exactly. Okay, next up, overconfidence.
Overconfidence is exactly what it sounds like, and Frank the Founder is the poster child.
Oh, absolutely. He built a highly successful software company, which required incredible operational skill. Because he is a genius in one specific domain, his ego incorrectly assumes he possesses transferable genius in entirely unrelated domains like macroeconomic forecasting or day trading commodities.
The technical term is the illusion of control. He thinks he can outsmart Wall Street hedge funds that literally have supercomputers.
The advisor's response here is to gently crush that ego with empirical data. You show him the SPA reports proving that over a 20-year period, 90% of professional active managers fail to beat a simple index fund. You use data to prove that market timing is a fool's errand.
Next up, mental accounting. Listener, perk up. This is a massive trap on the exam.
Mental accounting is the psychological tendency to treat money differently based on its source or intended use, completely ignoring the mathematical reality that all money is entirely fungible.
Fungibility basically means a dollar is a dollar. A dollar in your left pocket has the exact same purchasing power as a dollar in your right pocket.
But reckless Rick's brain doesn't see it that way. Rick diligently auto-deposits a portion of his biweekly salary into a very safe, boring savings account earning 1%. But when his $20,000 year-end corporate bonus hits his checking account, the dopamine floods his brain.
He categorizes this as play money or house money.
Right. He takes that $20,000 and day trades highly leveraged options on margin, completely convinced he is being smart because he didn't touch his salary savings.
Meanwhile, he is carrying a credit card balance charging him 24% interest.
It is entirely irrational. He could take that bonus, instantly wipe out his 24% debt, and guarantee himself a massive return. But because he put the bonus into a separate mental bucket labeled fun, he ignores the unified reality of his balance sheet. The advisor must force him to look at the consolidated math.
We have two more pairs of biases, confirmation bias and herding.
Confirmation bias is an information processing error. A bullish investor who loves a certain tech stock will actively search for, read, and believe positive articles about the company. But when a devastating negative earnings report comes out, they will dismiss it as fake news or claim the analysts just don't understand the vision.
They create an echo chamber.
Exactly. Herding is the biological urge to follow the crowd. It feels psychologically safer to be wrong with the crowd than to be wrong alone. It's why millions of people bought dot-com stocks at the absolute peak in 1999, or why they panic sold everything at the absolute bottom in March of 2009.
The herd is almost always wrong at the extremes of a market cycle. Finally, we have status quo and recency bias. Status quo is the path of least resistance. It's a refusal to change or rebalance a portfolio, even when life circumstances drastically change.
And recency bias, as we discussed earlier, is the assumption that the current market trend will continue forever.
The cure for recency bias is historical perspective. You show the client a chart of the last 100 years of the market. You show them that every bull market ends in a bear market, and every bear market gives birth to a bull market. Cycles exist.
Speaking of life changing, let's look at the life events checklist. Birth, death, marriage, divorce, a major inheritance, or a severe job loss.
When these happen, you immediately update the IPS. But there is one specific mechanical action the exam tests relentlessly.
Oh, this is the big one. Let's run the scenario. Frank, the founder, gets divorced. He updates his IPS, changes his risk tolerance, and reallocates his portfolio. 10 years later, Frank passes away. His multi-million dollar IRA is set to be distributed.
But wait, his ex-wife receives the entire account, and his new children get absolutely nothing. Why did that happen?
Because Frank forgot the single most important administrative step after a life event. He forgot to update his beneficiary designations on the actual account forms.
This is such a critical legal mechanic. A beneficiary form on an IRA or a life insurance policy legally supersedes a last will and testament.
It does not matter if Frank wrote a brand new will explicitly giving everything to his kids. The contract on file at the brokerage firm dictates the transfer of assets.
The exam writers love testing this because it is a devastating, irreversible, real-world error. Update the profile, update the IPS, but for the love of everything, update the beneficiaries immediately after any major life event.
Cannot stress that enough.
Let's bring all of this together in part 7, synthesis, the fiduciary context and the UPIA. We just spent an hour detailing all this extensive profiling, conflict resolution, and psychological handholding. Why are we legally required to do all of this?
It all comes down to the legal standard under which you operate. We have to draw a hard, bright line between a fiduciary standard and a suitability standard.
Let's look at the history here. As a candidate taking the Series 65, you are aiming to become an investment advisor representative. You fall under the Investment Advisors Act of 1940.
And that 1940 Act establishes a fiduciary duty. Being a fiduciary means you must act in the client's absolute best interest at all times.
So what does that entail?
This contains two distinct duties. First, the duty of care, which mandates the incredibly thorough, exhaustive profiling we just discussed. You have to know them deeply to advise them correctly. Second, the duty of loyalty. This means you must unequivocally subordinate your own financial interests to those of the client.
Basically meaning if Fund A pays you a higher commission, but Fund B is slightly cheaper and better for the client, a fiduciary must choose Fund B, full stop.
Exactly. Contrast that with a broker-dealer agent who traditionally operates under a suitability standard or the more recent regulation best interest. Under strict suitability, the recommendation just has to be reasonable for the client's profile.
It's basically the difference between a doctor and a car salesman. The car salesman just has to sell you a car that reasonably fits your family. A doctor has a Hippocratic oath to prescribe the absolute best treatment for your specific biology. Fiduciary means it is the absolute best option available, period.
That's a perfect analogy. And this fiduciary framework was fundamentally modernized for trust accounts in 1994 with the adoption of the UPIA, the Uniform Prudent Investor Act.
Okay, the UPIA. This is critical. Before 1994, fiduciaries managing trusts were terrified of buying anything risky, like a small cap stock or an emerging market fund.
Why?
Because if that single stock went bankrupt, the fiduciary could be sued personally for making an imprudent choice. They were forced to evaluate every single investment in total isolation,
which resulted in portfolios filled entirely with treasury bonds that got eaten alive by inflation. The UPIA changed everything by adopting modern portfolio theory. The core rule of the UPIA is that you must evaluate investments in the context of the total portfolio, not in isolation.
My analogy for this.
Yeah.
Evaluating an investment in isolation is like judging a heavy, insulated Arctic snowsuit in a vacuum. If you look at the snowsuit sitting in your living room, you might say, this is incredibly bulky, it's far too heavy, I'm sweating just looking at it, this is a terrible piece of clothing. But if you evaluate it in the context of your upcoming expedition to Antarctica, it is literally the only thing keeping you alive. Context is everything.
That is exactly how the exam will test the UPIA. They will give you a scenario where an advisor recommends a highly risky, complex derivative, like an option straddle or a short position.
On its own, it looks insanely speculative.
Right. But if that derivative is being used to hedge a massive, specific risk in a larger conservative portfolio, it might be a perfectly prudent investment under the UPIA. Total portfolio context is the legal shield.
Okay, we're in the home stretch. Let's do an exam question framework speed run. I'm going to rapid fire scenarios that mimic actual test questions, and you tell the listener what the advisor should do first. Ready?
Ready, let's go.
A brand new client walks into your office, sits down, and immediately demands to buy $100,000 of a specific mutual fund he read about online. What is your first action?
Gather complete information. You must complete the CIP to verify identity and gather full financials and objectives for suitability before executing any recommendation or even validating his idea.
Boom. Next. Anxious Annie's questionnaire shows she has conflicting objectives. She wants massive long-term growth, but absolutely zero risk of principal loss.
First, educate her on the mathematical impossibility of the conflict. Attempt to resolve it. If it remains ambiguous and she won't budge, default to the more conservative interpretation to protect her capital.
Love it. Reckless Rick states on his intake form that his risk tolerance is moderate, but his actual balance sheet shows he has massive high-interest credit card debt and zero liquid emergency fund.
Follow the financial reality, not the stated emotional preference. The math dictates his capacity is low. Capacity overrides willingness when capacity is low.
Final one. Frank, the founder, gets divorced and calls you to tell you the news.
Do not wait for the annual review next year. Update the profile and the IPS immediately, reallocate if necessary, and immediately update those account beneficiaries to remove the ex-spouse.
We have covered an incredible amount of ground today. Let's move to the outro and do a rapid-fire recap of the absolute top testable takeaways from this entire deep dive.
Number one. The CIP is about verifying identity to stop money laundering under the Patriot Act. Suitability is about assessing the financial picture. They are completely separate requirements.
Number two, the investment policy statement is a living document. When a client's life changes, you must update the IPS first before you buy or sell a single thing in the portfolio.
Number three, paying down debt with cash from savings does not instantly change your net worth. The assets and the liabilities decrease by the exact same amount simultaneously.
Number four, capital preservation, which focuses on absolute safety of principal, does not equal current income, which focuses on generating cash flow. Bonds can lose principal value if interest rates rise, so they fail a strict capital preservation test.
Number five, objective risk capacity overrides subjective risk willingness whenever capacity is low. You are a fiduciary professional, not a fast food order taker. You protect the client from themselves.
Number six, time horizon goes through retirement. Not just to it. A 65-year-old retiring tomorrow still has a 30-year time horizon and requires equity exposure to fight inflation.
Number seven, updating beneficiary designations is the single most critical administrative answer to almost every major life event scenario on the exam.
And number eight, investment advisors operate under a strict fiduciary standard of care and loyalty, evaluating investments in the context of the total portfolio under the Uniform Prudent Investor Act.
Before we sign off, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over as you continue your studying. We've spent the last hour talking extensively about resolving conflicts, gathering data, and creating the perfect, mathematically flawless, legally bulletproof investment policy statement.
A pristine document.
Exactly. But consider this. What happens to your fiduciary duty when the client's strictly mathematically rational plan meets an entirely irrational, panic-driven global market event like the pandemic or a massive financial crisis?
Oh, man.
Does that pristine IPS survive contact with true unprecedented chaos? Or do you eventually have to throw the rule book out the window to physically stop a client from liquidating their life savings at the absolute market bottom? Think about the psychology of how you would actually manage Anxious Annie on the worst, most terrifying red day in market history.
That is the real test, right there. The math breaks, snapshot gets blurry, and it's just you, the client, and the mud. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into client profile development. Good luck on your studying. Remember that truly understanding the why makes memorizing the what incredibly easy, and we'll see you on the next one.